change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program on the economic dimensions of our lives. Jobs, incomes, debts, children's college expenses, the hopes we have for our own futures, for that American dream we keep chasing, those of us in the U.S., and so on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I wanted to mention at the outset that the kind of analysis you're going to hear is available on the websites that I'll tell you more about later in the program. Let's jump right into the economic updates for today, the short, particular ones with which we begin every program. These days, a fight is in full swing in Washington, and it has to do, once again, with taxes. And one particular struggle that President Obama signaled in his State of the Union message is being fought over, and I want to talk a little bit with you about that. It has to do with what's called the capital gains tax. And since there's a lot of confusion, some of which is actively promoted by various battlers in this fight, I want to get as much clarity as we can. What is a capital gains tax? Well, let me tell you first what it isn't. It's not a tax on the work you do and the income you earn from your work. It's not a tax on wages. It's not a tax on salaries. Well, what is it a tax on? It's a tax on the increase in the value of property that you own. The most famous example would be a capital gains tax on shares of stock. If you buy a share of stock for $10 and you hold it for a while and then you sell it for $20, you've made a capital gain, it's called, of $10 on a share. You paid $10, you sold it for $20. The difference is gain you've achieved, a gain in the value of your capital, a capital gain. And the government taxes that, just like it taxes income that you get from wages and salaries. Okay? So a capital gains tax falls on the increase in the value of your property, and it is particularly relevant to bonds and stocks and these kinds of paper forms of value. Second fundamental reality. Most Americans in the United States don't have stocks and bonds. They don't have much property. They may have a house or a car. Capital gains taxes do not apply to automobiles. There is a kind of capital gains tax on your house, but it is a separate kind of tax. The capital gains tax most people mean when they talk about it is a tax on stocks and bonds, and most Americans don't have stocks and bonds at all, or certainly not as a major part of their financial situation. Stocks and bonds are held overwhelmingly by the richest people in the community. Therefore, it is neither surprising nor fair that the following fact is true. People who earn top dollar in our society pay a higher tax on the income they get from work than they pay on the income they get from the fact that their property goes up in value. That is, the capital gains tax has been, for example, about 20% for most people who suffer it, and that's a good bit less, almost half or less, what the top rate is on the tax of your work. And it has always been a source of upset to people to think that you pay more tax for the money you get by working than you pay tax on the money you get not by working, by having to do no work at all, simply by owning something. That is, the idea is it's harder to work than to own, and therefore you should be paying taxes at least equally, but certainly not less for what you don't have to work for than what you do. There's a second fact about the capital gains tax that is very important for you to know. And that is that there are a number of ways to escape it. By far the most important economically and socially in our country comes from something called the step-up basis. It's not important to worry about the name. Let me explain. If you buy a share of stock for $10 and it goes up to $20, if you sell that share of stock, you have to pay a capital gains tax, a certain percentage on the increase in the value of your share, with the following exception. If you die and leave the shares to somebody else, your children, your spouse, whatever, that increase will not be subject to the capital gains tax. In other words, the other person will be able to get that share, sell it for the $20, but will not owe the government any tax on the increase. You can avoid it by passing it to your children. This is a way that the wealthy, whose wealth is mostly in stocks and bonds, can take advantage of the law to leave that wealth to their children without their children having to pay a capital gains tax. This is a major way in which the super rich make sure their children are the super rich. And it's a way of frustrating the idea that we should all start at the same point, so it's our work and our capabilities and our energy that determines the outcome, rather than inheriting something that other people had before you. Now let's take a look at how the capital gains tax has been applied, at what levels in America, to give you an idea of who runs the show, if it wasn't already clear to you. In the 1970s, the capital gains tax was 40%. So in other words, if you bought a share of stock for 10 bucks and you sold it for 20 bucks, you would have to take four of those dollars, the extra 10 that you earned, and pay them to Uncle Sam. 40% of your gain, 40% of the $10 gain would have to go to the government. In the 1980s, that was dropped to 30%. In the 1990s, it was dropped to 20%. In the early years of this century, down to 15%. And since 2013, back up to 20 to 24%, depending on how rich you are. In other words, though, over the long haul of the last 30 to 40 years, the federal government dramatically reduced the tax on capital gains, far more than it reduced the tax on wages and salaries. The people who are the richest got the biggest cut in taxes, which is a major reason that the gap between rich and poor in the United States has gotten worse. If you're wondering why the government has to borrow so much money and we get this discussion of deficits, here's a big reason. Because we reduced the capital gains tax on the rich while allowing them to escape even that reduced tax by leaving it to their children. The tax system, and this is truer of the capital gains tax than anything else, is a system that worsens rather than offsets the inequalities emerging and deepening in the capitalist system in which we live. Next update, a quick, short, and sad one. A couple of weeks ago, here in New York City, where this program originates, in a Home Depot store, Home Depot being a national chain, I'm assuming most of you know what it is, a killing took place. A worker at the Home Depot brought a gun to work, killed a supervisor, and then himself. In the subsequent inquiries, and I followed this out of interest, it became crystal clear that, as was said by many who work at Home Depot, the pressures of the job, and this is in no way unique to Home Depot, I wouldn't mention it except that that's where it took place, and I want you to be clear about the specific facts of the matter. but in many, many stores, the push to make profit, the capitalist profit drive, makes employers cut wages, makes employers find ways of getting more work out of their workers, pressuring them, speeding up the work. They do that in order to show higher profit, which they boast about, and which maybe boosts the value of their shares on the market. But what too few people understand are the real costs. These are not costs for the company, but they're the costs in the quality of life, in the physical and mental health, and sometimes in the very life of the workers being stressed out under these conditions. This is happening to millions of our fellow citizens. It's producing mental and physical health costs. It's producing broken marriages, destroyed friendships. All of those things cost money, time, energy, and our emotional selves. None of those show up on the cost sheets and the profit sheets and the balance sheets of corporations, but they are real costs nonetheless. And when one worker kills another and then himself, it's time to begin to wonder whether what we don't count in a capitalist system isn't in the end much more important than what this strange system chooses to count and to measure. The last short update is in a way stunning. My guess is some of you have seen this story, but I think perhaps I can put it in a new and different light. Charles and David Koch, K-O-C-H, are well known. They are billionaires, among the 20 or 30 richest people on the planet, Americans, and they are extremely conservative. And they've been gathering other like-minded conservatives together to assemble money that they're going to be using. They've been doing this for years, but they are assembling money now, early in 2015, to use in the presidential campaign next year in 2016. And they had a big conference a couple weeks ago, and they announced with great fanfare that they have plans, together with the other conservatives they've gotten together, but they are by far the richest among them, to spend, and here we go now, $900 million on that presidential campaign next year. Why is that remarkable? Because that's an amount of money equal to what the Republican Party on the one hand and the Democratic Party on the other are likewise expected, more or less, to spend on both the presidential and congressional races next year. In other words, if you look at it financially, we have three players in the political fights of next year: the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and the conservative Koch Party. It's just not called that. And they'll be weighing in with their money. Well, on one hand, this is nothing new. I mean, last year, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars, too. But it is a milestone that now the Koch brothers' conservative money machine is at the same level as the Republican and Democratic political parties. It is showing, and here's the point I want to make, the complete subordination of our political discourse, our debates, our public media exposure, the filling of the airwaves with ideas and propositions and arguments and claims and demands, often unverified, often false. But there in our minds and on the tube as we watch, because someone has the money to pay for that, and the business interests dominate the Republican Party's contributions. We already know that. And they dominate the Democratic Party contributions. And they obviously dominate the Koch brothers, since that's overwhelmingly who they gather, wealthy, conservative businessmen and women. So the business community has bought not just this or that candidate, but the whole operation, the whole atmosphere, the whole debate. Anybody who's unacceptable to the business community in any general way, for example, a critic of the system, sort of the way Alex Tsipras's Syriza party functioned in Greece, has what of a chance in this society with this kind of financial domination? And you know, all of these efforts to pass campaign finance reform, this law, that law, well-intentioned for sure, making a little difference here or there, probably. But for the big picture, for what I've just described, here's the reality. As fast as we pass regulations, reforms, and laws, hard as it is even to do that, but as fast as we do it, they find the ways to get around those laws, to put into office people who will amend the laws, repeal the laws. This is a game. We do not overcome the control of our politics by the rich few amongst us unless and until we stop creating a rich few amongst us. How often does this lesson have to be drummed in to the minds of the American and other people before the lesson is learned? If you don't want to corrupt politics with money, you cannot equip some citizens with billions and others having a hard time making ends meet. Because those with the billions, knowing that they are the minority, and those without enough, who are the majority, those with the minimum of political morality know that if they're going to stay a rich minority, they have to control the politics. They cannot allow a system to work in which the mass who don't have wealth will have the majority of votes. So if they have those votes, you've got to control what they know, what they think, what they hear, and what they see. And the money of the rich is used to keep them from any risk of democratic control. And that means you have to change the system that leads to that outcome. Otherwise, your marginal regulations and reforms will not work. Let me turn now, as we do in the program, to responding to some of your questions. And again, I've selected from them those that seem to be of broad interest to many of you. And as I'll mention again a little bit later in the program, you can send us your questions through the websites that I'll be talking to you about. All right, the first question is, could you tell us, bring us up to date, about the conditions of children in the United States? And in particularly, what is the story of child poverty in the United States? Well, in doing the research to answer this question and bring it up to date, I had the good fortune to discover that very, very well-known and highly respected institutions have been working on this. And in January of 2015, the Children's Defense Fund and the Urban Institute, two, as I say, well-known and well-respected research agencies and action agencies, did a report on child poverty in the United States. And here are some of the things they found, and here are some of their regulation responses and proposals, and I want to briefly talk with you about them. First, among the 35 industrialized countries, the United States, despite having the largest economy in the world, has the second highest level of child poverty. I'm going to do that again. Among the 35 most industrialized countries in the world, the United States ranks number 2 in child poverty. A child in the United States right now, 2015, has a 1 in 5 chance of being poor. A child of color, and remember, colored Americans will be in the majority of U.S. children by the year 2020. That's in 5 years. A child of color is twice as likely to be poor as a white child. Growing up poor, which we're talking now about 20% of children in the United States, growing up poor. If you grow up poor, we know, we've done all the studies we need to, you will more likely have physical problems, illness. Your education will be interrupted, slowed, and less than if you weren't poor. Your mental problems will be greater than if you are not poor. Your relationships will have a harder time being stable and secure. There will be all kinds of social costs that you will incur and the society you live in will incur when you are an adult if you were poor as a child. Letting a fifth of our children grow up poor is an act of self-destruction of our society. So what do the Children's Defense Fund and the Urban Institute, what do they propose? Well, basically, and this issue keeps coming up, so I need to deal with it, they propose some familiar liberal ideas. Raise the minimum wage, improve tax breaks for poor people, give subsidies to education for poor people. You know these proposals. You've heard them all your life. And every one of them would help the situation. But none of them gets at the root of the problem. And therefore, one is required, just by honesty, to say, what about these proposals should make us get excited about them, since these kinds of proposals have been made for decades, have in various ways at various times been at least partially implemented, and yet here we are in 2015 with a child poverty program that is staggering compared to what we should have, staggering compared to what other advanced industrial countries have. What's going on? Well, the answer again is we have a fundamental problem in our economic system. That fellow from France, the economist, Thomas Piketty, whose book Capital in the 21st Century was such a sensation in 2014 and still is. His book showed that capitalism as a system for 300 years has a constantly reasserted tendency to produce extremes of wealth at one pole and economic difficulty, a nice term for poverty, at the other. And that only periodic upsurges of popular anger temporarily interrupt this underlying tendency. Well, that's why we have poverty with us. We live in an economic system that keeps reproducing the poles of extreme wealth at one end and poverty for large numbers of people, particularly children, at the other. So the conclusion is really inescapable. If you want finally to deal with this problem, deal with an economic system that keeps reproducing poverty alongside of extreme wealth. Stop paying attention to the great wealth at one end and pay attention to the abject and socially self-destructive poverty at the other. And the way to do that is to deal with the system so it doesn't produce that. Wages should not be small relative to profits. That's an inappropriate way of organizing production and income distribution in a society. We've tried and failed to persuade those at the top to share their wealth. We have taxed them and regulated them, and they have outwitted us by adjusting, amending, and escaping those controls, which I document almost every week, and so does a significant part even of the mainstream media. It's such a scandal. Well, again, the lesson is change the system or else you're not serious about this. And what do I mean? Put the mass of people in charge of deciding how production works and how you distribute the fruits of our labor. Let me be as stark as I can. If a corporation, any corporation, large, medium, small, if it decided how to distribute the revenues it earns from whatever it produces, from whatever it does, if it decided how to do that democratically, all the people who work in the enterprise get together and decide on a reasonable, fair distribution of the output, of the profits, for example. Do you think they would give a handful of top executives $10, $20, $30 million while the average employee hasn't got enough to send their kid to college? It's not going to happen. The reason we have a tiny number of wealthy people is because we allow our businesses to be run by the same tiny number of people. This isn't rocket science. You want to change the distribution of income. You want to make it fairer. You want to make it more democratic. Well, then make the operation of the enterprise fair and democratic. Put the distribution of the profits in the hands of all the people whose work helped to produce those profits. Then you will get a reasonably fair distribution. The workers may decide to give some more to some people than others, but the difference won't be enormous. I've enjoyed telling you about that famous company in Mondragon, Spain, the co-op, the worker co-op, which passed a rule years ago, which they enforce and have enforced for decades, that the highest paid person can't get more than 8 times what the lowest paid one gets. Now, that's quite a difference, 8 times. But it pales in comparison to what the average CEO of a large American company gets relative to the lowest paid worker, which is in the neighborhood of 200 or 300 times. We get extreme wealth here, and they don't in the Mondragon Corporation, which is, by the way, the 7th largest corporation in all of Spain. They have managed to grow from 6 workers in 1956 to 100,000 workers today, outcompeting many capitalist countries, but not having a wildly unequal distribution of income. A worker co-op made that decision, and a worker co-op preserved that decision. And that's an enormously important lesson. I do want to remind you that this kind of a program and these kinds of analyses are available to you on our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both websites are available to you 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. In addition, both websites give you a way to communicate to us thoughts, questions, criticisms. We read every one and we use them to shape this program. Both websites also allow you to click on the icons for Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, which will enable you to follow us on a very intimate kind of way. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis. They're something to check out as well if this kind of program interests you. Welcome back to the second half of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. In this second half of the program, I will be focusing on a number of major issues, as we often do in the second half, when we do not have a guest to be interviewed. Today, I want to respond to communications from many of you in the form of talking about what are the problems, the major problems facing the U.S. economy in the beginning of 2015. And I wanted to preface this by noting that recently the Federal Reserve let it be known that the expectation that they would be raising interest rates, something that conservatives and others have been pushing for quite a while, has been postponed yet again. And we were told that nothing like that would happen until the middle or even the later part of this year. The reason for that is a good way to get into the condition of the American economy today. The reason for that is it's simply too dangerous that the United States economy is in bad shape and could really spin out of control if the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. Because, of course, that would make buying a home more expensive because the mortgage rates would go up and the housing market is in trouble in this country, only sustained by government supports at this point. It would make buying a car more expensive, and that would be a major trouble for the automobile industry. And it would make our credit cards more expensive and so on. So they're not going to do it. It's too dangerous. And there's a sign that the, quote, so-called recovery is hardly there and shaky at best. So what are the problems that prompted the Federal Reserve not to move to raise interest rates, keep interest rates virtually at zero, keep pumping money into the economy, which they are doing? And I wanted to make sure we all understood what the clouds are on the horizon that suggest that a recovery in the United States, which really has only benefited the top 10%, the people who own shares, the profiteers, the top executives, and has bypassed the majority of Americans, and the same is true in Europe, Japan, and elsewhere. What are the headwinds? What are the problems? And there are several. First, the major trading partner for the United States is Europe. The European economy is in very, very bad shape, considerably worse than the United States. Major economies there are in recession. Others are threatening recession. The European Central Bank has just embarked on a massive money increase, money printing, quantitative easing, the polite term, program. So the Europeans are not in a position to buy American goods. They're our most important trading partner. That means American companies are not going to be able to sell to a European economy that's in economic trouble. But it's worse than that. Precisely because the Europeans are pumping their money supply up, the value of the euro is dropping. And the value of the American currency is rising. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes because we're going to talk about currency wars. And that's wrapped up in this question of the relationship between the European currency, the euro, and the dollar. But for the moment, when the euro falls, it makes European goods cheaper. It means that a dollar gets you more euros than it used to, because a dollar's worth more and the euro's worth less. And that means any product produced in Europe, which is priced in euros, costs you less dollars to buy. In short, European goods will be bought by Americans more, because cheaper. And that means Americans will buy fewer American goods, which will hurt American companies, who will therefore lay off workers. Whoops, you see where that goes. So Europe will buy less from the United States, whereas the United States will buy more from Europe, and both of those things impact the United States economy negatively. So that's a very worrisome situation. Second, the second biggest economy in the world today is China. and China's economic growth, which has been spectacular for 25 years, is now slowing. It's still much faster than the growth of the United States, a fact that itself merits a long discussion, but we won't do that today. But the Chinese, still growing much faster than the United States, several times faster, is nonetheless slowing down. And that slowdown also impacts the United States in a variety of ways that are mostly negative. The Chinese can buy less. The Chinese move the world economy with less than they used to. And they used to be the real engine, especially after the crisis of 2007. So the Chinese are a drag now as they slow down. Because the Chinese are slowing down, they are not buying energy, metals, minerals, the way they used to from third world countries. Places like Latin America, Asia, Africa were having a relatively good several years because the raw materials, the food, the minerals, the metals that they produce, the energy, was being gobbled up by the Chinese because their economy was booming. Now that the Chinese economy slows down, it needs less of that, less iron from Australia, less copper from Chile, less energy than before, etc. And so the third world, what we nowadays call the emerging markets, are not booming the way they used to, and that means they're not buying as much from the United States as they used to. So for all of these reasons, the supports of American economic well-being, Europe, China, the emerging markets, are all playing that role less. But we're not done. As important as all of those that I've just mentioned are, there's another one that's even more important, that's domestic, here in the United States, that's a real problem. We have become a much more unequal society. Let's see how that works. More and more of the income we generate goes into very few hands, the richest amongst us. More and more the middle and the bottom are pinched. Less of our income is going to the middle and the bottom. More of the nation's income is going to the super rich. Why is that important? The super rich, precisely because they are super rich, don't spend the money they earn. They save it. They hold it back. They place it in other countries to spread the risk. The mass of people are the ones who used to spend pretty much what they got. The middle and lower classes in the United States don't save much. Never did. They spend it pretty much as fast as they get it, buying goods and services. If you take money away from people, income away from people who spend it, and give it to the super rich who save it, guess what? Less spending. It becomes harder and harder for stores, factories to sell to a population, most of whom are pinched. So the very inequality in the United States is changing the way we work. And it's hobbling many of our industries that serve the mass of people, even as it produces great profits for those who serve the super rich. But when you put all that together, the total spending by the super rich is less than what is lost in the spending of the middle and the bottom. And that is a serious headwind to the American economy. And since nothing is happening in a political way, in a society dominated by the super rich, nothing is happening to change the deepening inequality of income, this continues to be a drag on the functioning of the American economy, and there is no end in sight. So that's why the recovery hasn't meant much to most Americans. That's why we keep being told it's going to get better, but it doesn't for most people. That's why even the people getting jobs are getting them at much lower wages and salaries than they had before, with much poorer benefits than they had before. And that's why the Federal Reserve can't raise interest rates the way they said they were going to, because the situation is too precarious. And that's a very important point for me to get across to you and with you. Let me turn then to this matter of currency. A lot of people seem to be mystified by this, but there really is no need to. Let me explain what's at stake. Most of Europe is now in what's called the Eurozone. They have one currency, where before they had many. Used to have the French franc and the Deutsche Mark and the Italian lira and so on. Now, all those countries have one currency, the euro, just like all the different states of the United States have one currency, the dollar. There are some countries that are not in the euro, but they're in Europe. Britain has retained its own currency. Switzerland has retained its own currency. Denmark has, and a few others. But most of Europe is in the eurozone. Every day in the world, people and businesses have to convert one kind of currency into another. Let me give you a simple example. When you buy a bottle of French wine in a store, you pay a dollar in an American store, or 10 or 20 or 30, for that bottle. And the storekeeper expects to be paid in dollars. And the storekeeper uses those dollars to pay the wholesaler from whom he or she got that bottle of wine. But somewhere down the road, somebody has to pay the French vineyard owner, the French wine producer, and he wants to be paid, or she wants to be paid, in euros, because that's the currency in France. So at some point, it can vary where, but at some point, someone who has a dollar has to convert it into euros to pay for that wine. Okay, so somewhere, someone has to sell a dollar to get a euro, or if you like, exchange a dollar for a euro. Now here comes the interesting part. The question is, how many euros do you get for a dollar? Let's suppose for the French wine producer, the cost, the price he charges for the wine, is, 10 euros. Okay, then you have to give up enough dollars to get 10 euros. And let's suppose it's 1-to-1. 1 euro to $1. It isn't right now, although it's moving in that direction. But let's make it simple. 1 euro, $1. So you would have to give up $10 to get your 10 euros, and that would be the cost to you of the bottle of wine at 10 euros. But now let's assume, just for simplicity, that the value of the euro drops by half. So for $1, you get 2 euros. The wine produced in France still costs 10 euros. Nothing has changed in France. They produce the wine, they offer it 10 euros a bottle. But for us as Americans, when we go into the store, we don't have to pay, as we used to, $10 to get 10 euros to get the wine. We only have to come up with 5 euros, because 5 euros gets you 10, $5 gets you 10 euros. So for us, the Americans who buy, we only have to come up with half as much in dollars to get that 10 euro bottle of wine. So for us in America, the wine has become cheaper, not for the French who produce it, just for the Americans who buy it. Nothing has changed in the production of wine. Nothing has changed for us. It's the relationship between the euro and the dollar that has changed. So now let me point out what the point of all of this is. If your currency loses value, the products you produce become cheaper in every other country of the world. If the euro goes down, the cost to us in America, or indeed to anybody outside of the eurozone, the cost of that wine becomes less, because you'd have to give up less of your own currency to get a euro. The euro has dropped dramatically this last year by 15, 20, 25%. That has made all European goods cheaper for Americans, for British, for Asians. It is a way that the Europeans, and here's the punchline, it is a way that the Europeans are seeking to dig their way out of the global capitalist crisis that has been so hard on all of Europe. They're going to try to do better, they think, by driving down the value of their euro so that everything produced in Europe will have a bigger market outside of Europe, because everything produced in Europe, if the value of the euro goes down, is cheaper for everybody else. Is this a strategy that can work for the Europeans? Well, the Japanese have been doing it too. Will it work? The answer is maybe, but that's the best you can say. Let's see why. Problem number one, for the European strategy to succeed, driving down the value of their currency relative to the dollar, to the British pound, to the Japanese yen, and so on, for that to succeed, people around the world have to switch from buying goods made in their own country to buying goods made in Europe, which they may do because the price of goods produced in Europe has come down in their own currencies. But then a howl will go up. Here in the United States, the howl will say, hey, we American companies are losing business as Americans, and indeed people around the world, switch to the cheaper euro-priced goods. We don't want that. Well, what happens then? Those companies go to the United States government and say, don't let the euro go down relative to the dollar. Well, how would the American government stop it? Answer, drive down the value of the dollar. Don't let the Europeans be the only ones playing the game. And there are a variety of ways of doing that. In other words, you might begin to have an effort by the Europeans to get more exports out of their area by lowering their price, fail to achieve its objectives because they provoke others to try to do the same thing, partly to protect themselves against what the Europeans are doing, and partly to play the same game themselves in reverse. These are called currency wars, when countries no longer cooperate with one another to try to solve a problem that is the capitalist system as a whole, as a global system, but instead everybody goes it alone. The real shocker that happened not so long ago showing this was a decision by the Swiss National Bank to stop controlling the value of the Swiss franc relative to the euro, which for Switzerland is the most important other currency beside its own. Why did the Swiss do that? Because they were terrified about these currency wars that were beginning to break out, and no longer having confidence that the world's capitalist powers, United States, Europe, Japan, and others, would get together to manage it, the Swiss decided we better do what's good for us, and they allowed their currency to go up in value, which is an interesting decision that they made, in which they kind of give up on playing this game. They're going to try to solve their economic problems in another way. But the important lesson is every country's central bank, Bank of England, Bank of France, Bank of Japan, or here in the United States, the Federal Reserve System, which is what we call our central bank, each of these is now more and more thinking about itself, going its own way. And the end result of that may be now a repetition, if you like, of what happened in the 1930s, when countries warred against each other with the end result that it was worse for everybody. But I'm not surprised, because in a capitalist system, that's how things tend to go, because you breed in everybody this competitive attitude, this I don't care where the chips may fall, everything is my business, my survival, that should transmit itself into the values of your political leaders isn't all that surprising. Last point. Is it impossible for a country to win in the currency wars, or is there something it can do to win even if things aren't going so well in the currency wars? And the answer is yes. A country can get more exports even if it can't control or manipulate its currency if it drops the prices of everything it produces. And that's called a deflation. Sometimes countries do that on purpose. Sometimes countries have no choice. If their economies begin to collapse, businesses are threatened with going out of business, so they try to save themselves by lowering their prices. And everybody lowers their prices, and workers' wages get driven down. You can have a deflation. It's the opposite of an inflation. An inflation is when all prices rise. A deflation is when all prices fall. Greece, in its years of difficulty, experienced deflation. Other countries in Europe are experiencing or getting close to deflation. That is a way to try to dig your way out of a crisis in the hopes that other people buy your goods, not because your currency changed in value, that was the earlier story, but because your prices have come down. And that is a very painful thing for a society to go through. Everybody's being frustrated by being unable to sell what they had planned to sell at price X by having to be satisfied with price less than X. It's another sign of an economic system that isn't working well for most people. Whether it's a currency war or a postponed interest rate hike or a deflation, more and more what I have to talk about on this program are signs and indicators of an economic system breaking down, not working, resisting the efforts of political leaders to fix it. You have to be blind at this point not to see the level of difficulty, whether it's child poverty, whether it's one or another of these signs of dysfunction. They really are everywhere. And they together add up to the signs of a system that isn't working. And if nothing else gets across on this program, that is a major part of my message. So to conclude today's program, and to conclude it on a better note, I wanted to make sure everybody was aware that there are interesting things happening in a variety of places that deserve our applause and our attention. And in particular, there is this recognition growing that the organization of business we call capitalist, you know, a tiny number of rich shareholders who together elect a board of directors who run the business. They hire everybody else. They decide the wages and salaries. They decide what's to be produced, how it's to be produced, where it's to be produced, and what's to be done with the profits. Even though everybody helps make the profits, this tiny group of board of directors, 15, 20 people, make all the decisions. There's more and more of a recognition that this is a major root of the system's dysfunction. This is leaving to these handful of people moving the factory out of the country, not paying taxes, paying low wages, polluting the atmosphere. We can't solve our problems with this way of organizing business. That if we want business to serve everybody, we've got to put everybody in charge. We've got to democratize the enterprise, a theme on this program, as those of you who listen know well. Well, here's the good news with which I want to end today's program. Last year in New York City, the city council, the elected officials, set aside a modest sum, $1.2 million, to help research and fund worker cooperatives, enterprises not organized in the capitalist way with top-down leadership, handful of shareholders, board of direct. No. A worker co-op where the workers all together democratically decide. And now, I recently learned that another city in the United States, much smaller than New York, has gone one better. Madison, Wisconsin, recently allocated $5 million for much the same purpose, to research and support worker cooperatives. Indeed, Wisconsin has thousands of worker cooperatives of one kind or another, community cooperatives, consumer cooperatives, as well as worker cooperatives. But this is in order to promote cooperatives. I think these signs in New York and Madison are important because they are recognitions by growing numbers of American citizens and even American elected officials that we don't want to go down with the capitalist ship. We have to figure out if there are better alternative ways of organizing our economy by reorganizing how we do business. Because the other ways of solving our problems, laws and regulations, leaving the capitalist organization of production intact, simply aren't working. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.